Hey, it's Scott, and guess what? You're about to hear an ad. And that's both good and bad. It's good because ads are what make it possible for me to keep bringing you these episodes. And it's bad because, well, maybe you don't like listening to ads, and I get that. And the good news is, you don't have to. When you sign up to support the show, you get every single episode without any ads. Plus, you get all the bonus episodes. Yeah, did you know there are actually bonus episodes? And you can try it all for free just to see what it's like. If you're on an iPhone, just go to the What Was That Like podcast and at the top, click on Try Free and you're in. On Android, just go to whatwasthatlike.com/plus and try it out completely free. Once you've had the ad-free experience, you'll see why hundreds of other listeners are already doing it. But for now, here's another ad and then on with today's episode. I'll confess, sometimes I let my podcast playlist get out of hand and I get way behind, but there's one show that I subscribe to and any new episode goes right to the top of the queue. That's the Jordan Harbinger Show. That's because I never have to figure out, okay, is this one going to be interesting or do I wait for the next one like I do for some shows? Because Jordan's conversations are always a must listen for me. He talks to fascinating people from any category you can think of. Authors, scientists, athletes, you name it. He's talked to undercover cops who posed as mafia and the actual career mafia hitmen. And the stories he gets out of these people, just incredible. In one episode, he talked to Paul Holes. You might know that name if you're into true crime. He's the former investigator who uses really advanced methods to solve cold cases, including the Golden State Killer. And another one I really enjoyed was with Sam Harris, an author and neuroscientist who promotes skepticism, and he doesn't mind taking on some seriously controversial topics like politics or religion. That one's going to make you think. Whenever a new episode of the Jordan Harbinger Show pops up, I already know it's going to be an episode that I'll enjoy listening to, and I'll bet you will too. For some episode recommendations, check out jordanharbinger.com/start. Or search for the Jordan Harbinger Show. That's H-A-R-B as in boy, I-N as in Nancy, G-E-R, on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
What Was That Like? Contains adult language and content and is not intended for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised.
And I was treading water, and I just started to assess with my hands, and I just kind of like started like patting myself down. And when my right hand got to the back, I just reached inside my leg and realized like at that point that it was really bad.
Welcome to What Was That Like? I'm your host, Scott Johnson. This is the show where we talk to regular people, people just like you or just like me, who have found themselves in an extremely unusual situation. We'll hear their stories and get inside their head because we all want to know, what was that like? More information about each episode at whatwasthatlike.com. Here we go. If you're a parent, you can probably identify a little bit with this story, especially if you have teenagers. My kids are grown now, but I remember back when they were teenagers, and my kids were really good. They never got in any trouble or anything like that. But even with responsible, mature teenagers, you just dread that someday you might get a phone call. It's that phone call from one of your kids that starts out, "Now, Dad, I don't want you to freak out or anything, but something happened." Weston was 18 years old when he had to make that phone call to his parents one summer day. He and a couple of his friends, they were all teammates on the high school football team, were out on a boat all day. Just before it started to get dark, Weston was standing out on the bow and he fell forward off the boat into the water. The boat and the spinning propeller under the water's surface continued forward directly to where Weston was treading water. He couldn't move out of the way quickly enough. He survived, of course, but what happened that day is something he still thinks about even today. This podcast is supported by you, the listener. If you like these stories, please consider joining the others who support the show for as little as $1 a month at whatwasthatlike.com/support. And now, please enjoy my conversation with Weston. How would you describe your level of tolerance for pain?
I would say that I have a pretty high pain tolerance. I'm not sure if it's always been that way, but just before the accident, I've had so many different traumas. I've broken both arms, leg, elbows, wrists, ribs, nose, fingers. So,
wow. You've had a lot of injuries, man.
Yeah, I gave my parents a run for their money. So I don't know if it was just a culmination and, you know, this was the final thing. But during the accident, I don't remember specifically, but they asked me on a scale from 1 to 10, where are you? And I think my answer was 6. I just remember my uncle was in the room. And he said, he's a 10. He'll be a 10 for the next hour. He'll be a 10 for the next day. And he'll be a 10 for the next week. So act accordingly. I was like, it's a 6.
But you've had so many other instances of pain that relative to those, it was not that bad then.
Yeah, it might still be the worst, but the way that accident specifically happened, you know, cut through nerves, and I didn't really know what had happened initially. But I would say I have higher pain tolerance than most just based on the things that I've been through. And I don't know if that's something you can build up or if you're just born that way. And that might be why I've gotten into so many different accidents, because I don't have my body telling me to stop doing something until it's too late, essentially.
Yeah, it's too late. Can you tell us where you were kind of at in life when this happened? You were in high school, right?
Yep. It was the summer between my junior and senior year of high school. I'd say my main focus, for the last 10 years was football. I was coming off of a all-conference offense and defense, and I was an all-state linebacker my junior season. So I was poised going into my senior season to hopefully have a pretty good chance at playing in college, or at least maybe walking onto a team or something along those lines.
So you were hoping maybe to be seen by some college scouts sometime during your senior year, maybe?
Yeah, that was the plan. I had gone on a visit before. You know, I had a few coaches that I was talking to. It wasn't anything crazy, but we had started pursuing that. And that was actually the day that it happened was the afternoon. That morning was the first day of football workouts, and we went boating as kind of a reward to ourselves for finishing the first day and kind of getting into the start of the off-season program.
I would imagine that if you're thinking football going into your senior year of high school and then thinking to play possibly in college, that would be kind of the dominant thing in the back of your head kind of all the time. Like, this is that may be the direction your life is going, maybe even as a pro career. Did you think about that at all?
I always wanted to. I'd say physically, I probably didn't have the frame to play professional ball, but that was definitely a dream. I wanted to.
And if you were talented enough, that could pay for your college.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that was one of the driving motivations.
The day of the accident, who were you with on the boat?
I was with Brent and Jeremy. We were three linebackers on the football team, and we basically went it's like an hour drive north to Jeremy's grandmother's house. It was her boat. So we finished football practice, got in the car, went up. And we spent all afternoon on the boat. We were doing wakeboarding, tubing, and went back to the house and had dinner. Before we went back out on the boat, we were going to do some night fishing and finish out the day with just a little bit of fishing.
What kind of boat was this?
It was a pontoon boat. I don't know the specifics of like what type, but yeah, it was a pontoon boat.
When you say pontoon boat, I've been on pontoon boats here in Florida, and they're typically pretty slow.
Yeah, we weren't going fast at all. We were, I guess I would say, trolling. We had caught our bait, and we were just coasting, essentially. The boat was on, the propeller was engaged, and we were just making our way to where we were going to do the fishing.
But when you talk earlier about wakeboarding, it seems like you'd need a faster boat to do something like that.
Yeah, ideally you would, but that was the boat we had, so they made do with it.
All right, so you were planning to do some fishing, And it was you and Brent and Jeremy, just the three of you on the boat.
Yep. Yep. Just us three.
So you guys took off and you were on this was on a lake, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Carr Lake on the border of North Carolina and Virginia.
So just take us through what happened.
I remember just standing on the front and I was in shorts and a t-shirt because, you know, we weren't planning on swimming. I wasn't planning on getting in the water the rest of the day. And there's a little gate that you can open up with two seats out on the front of the pontoon boat and then nothing else except for, you know, just a ledge to the water. And I was standing on the front just kind of enjoying the air because I think pretty certain I was sunburnt just from being out on the lake the entire day prior.
So you were on the front of the boat and there was no rail or anything there
correct,
in front of
correct.
You.
Correct. Yep. Okay. It was just open air. And I'm not sure if music was playing or what, but yeah, I guess Jeremy thought, oh, it would be funny if I kill the engine and then start it back up again to kind of shake the boat, similar to a brake check in a car. And obviously he didn't let me know. So all of this, I feel a jolt and kind of lose my balance. And I just feel myself going forward. So I essentially, I guess, jump in or fall in. And I don't own a boat or didn't spend much time. And the propeller didn't cross my mind. I think what was going through my head was, oh, crap, my clothes are getting wet. And I don't have a change of clothes. So that was the last thing I remember before going in. And I guess by the nature of the pontoon boat, there's nothing in between me and the propeller at that point. The hull is on the left and the right.
So you fell off forward right in the center of the boat.
Correct. Yep.
But that's off the front of the boat and the motor, the engine's in the back,
yep.
Right?
Yep.
How did you meet up with the propeller?
Yeah. In a boat, when you do, I guess, a brake check or whatever he did, kill the engine, the boat's still carrying forward, not fast. And I don't know that he re-engaged the engine immediately, but the propeller was definitely still spinning when it, you know, the boat traveled however many 20 feet before it made contact with me. I feel pretty certain that he killed the engine as soon as he saw me go off, but there's not, to my knowledge, a braking mechanism on the propeller. It would keep spinning until, you know, it naturally slowed down, but it hadn't stopped by the time that it hit my hamstring or my leg. And I knew that the boat hit me, but it didn't even process in my head that it could have been the propeller. I just remember immediately just feeling almost like a cramp is probably how I would describe it. Like somebody hit me in the back of the leg with a baseball bat or something. Like I definitely got hit and I knew that, you know, it was painful, but I wouldn't say it was sharp. It was just almost like somebody hit me with something. And the first thing I realized was like I was stuck. And I don't know if it was my suit was tangled in the propeller or what it was. But I couldn't get out. So I ended up having to like trying to fight my way out of my shorts and to get out from under the boat and to get up above water to where I could breathe.
So the time when the propeller hit you, you were completely submerged at that point.
Correct. Yep. I was underwater. And the only thing that was going through my head was like, not that I was injured, but it was like, I'm embarrassed because now I don't have shorts. They're off. So I'm going to be treading water naked. And I remember thinking like, oh, this is going to suck. It's going to be really embarrassing when I get back to the boat. So I was behind the boat, I'd say probably 15 or 20 feet because I could still see it and I could still talk to him. And I was treading water and I just started to assess with my hands. And I just kind of like started like patting myself down. And when my right hand got to the back, I just reached inside my leg and realized like at that point that it was really bad. And I think that's what maybe there was some panic in my voice, but I just kind of like called out to him, like, it's really bad. And they were like, okay, come over here. So I kind of swam over to the side of the boat, the side of the pontoon boat. And Brent just grabbed my hand and pulled me out of the water. At the time I was probably close to 200 pounds. And I don't know if it was just adrenaline, but I didn't need any assistance. He just pulled me right out and I was laying right there on the side of the pontoon boat. And I could see instantly that they were in shock, essentially, because they were seeing. And I asked them, like, how bad is it? And, like, just their faces, the expressions on them. I think they responded, it's really bad. And I couldn't see it because it's on the back of my leg, but I could look down and kind of to the side, and I could see the fat and meat and blood kind of just hanging down from the side. And yeah, I knew it was pretty bad at that point.
And of course, the hamstring is on the back of your leg.
Yep.
So you couldn't really get a good look at it.
But. Yeah, and I didn't want to really move. I don't remember feeling pain at that point in time. I think I was more focused on like what we need to do to fix this. And one of the first thoughts in my head was like, this is going to like mess up my football season. Like my coach is going to be pissed essentially. And I didn't know the extent of it, but I remember Brent was wearing a long sleeve shirt. So I said, hey, take the shirt off. I need to tie that around my leg. So he tossed me the shirt and I tied, I guess, essentially a makeshift tourniquet. I didn't have any type of leverage to really get it tight. And I'm not certain that it really did anything, but, yeah, at that point, we didn't have cell service on the lake. So Jeremy started the boat back up, and we were driving back to the dock so that we could call 911 and get some help.
How far were you from the shore?
I want to say it was probably 5 to 10 minutes, but I don't remember time from like in that hour very specifically. It didn't take long. I remember once we got to the dock, Brent sprinted up to the house to get to a landline to call.
So this was just a random house that you saw the dock and
No, it was his grandmother's house. We went back to okay. his house. So he sprinted up, called 911. It was me and Jeremy. He kind of pulled me under his arm, essentially, like you know, a player hurt on a football field to help carry him off. So I was just hobbling with my left leg to a golf cart that we had driven down to the dock with. And I remember like it was starting to hurt, and I remember it being painful to get onto the golf cart and kind of get situated to where I could hang on to drive back up to the house. I mean, it wasn't far. It might have been a 1 or 2 minute drive, but I just remember the bumps on the path is when the pain started to come in.
And you must have been bleeding all over the place.
Yeah, I don't remember the blood. The only reason I'm alive is no major arteries were severed.
That's what's really amazing about this, because, you know, you clip an artery and then you probably could have bled out before you could even get anywhere.
Correct. The doctor said if my leg was smaller, then I most likely would have bled out in the water. It would have hit a bone or an artery or a vein, and I would have bled out in the water. So I guess I attribute a lot of that to like the strength and conditioning program, because we were all in good shape and we were pretty strong guys. So I guess the mass of my leg is what ended up keeping me from severing an artery. Or
the key to remember here is never skip leg day.
Exactly. Yeah. Never skip leg day. And thankfully that was always my favorite workouts. I never did skip leg day because it was my favorite.
This is the question. I know when we were online with this, the question everybody was asking or wondering about, even if they didn't ask, just the leg or any other important parts?
No, it was just the leg. Very fortunate. Yeah, it was, I guess, three major cuts in my hamstring into the belly of the hamstring. And then 8 to 10 superficial cuts that kind of like went up towards my butt or my glutes. I think one of those cuts needed stitches, and the other ones, they just let heal by themselves.
So did you remain conscious the whole time?
I did. I still firmly believe that I was in a better state of mind than the other people. And I don't know if it's because they knew the extent of it, and I just thought I cut my leg. But I asked for the phone. I called my parents. I specifically remember dialing. My mom picked up, and I said, oh, hey, Mom, can I talk to Dad, please? Because I didn't want to, I guess, worry her or tell her over the phone. And I'm sure she knew instantly. I mean, we had been through this. I'd hurt myself dozens of times up until this point, so she probably knew then. And I tell my dad, I was like, I don't want you to freak out. I cut my leg. It's pretty bad. And they're wanting to take me to this hospital. And we were in the country, and they kept saying Mariah Perm, and I didn't understand what they were saying. So I was trying to relay this to my dad. Like, they're taking me to Mariah Perm, and that didn't, I didn't know what they were saying, but apparently it was the name of the hospital. And at that point, the EMTs had gotten there and needed to ask me some questions. So I passed the phone off to somebody else. But I was able to answer all the questions. I wasn't freaking out. I think I was pretty calm, but I was able to, my birthday, what day is it? What year is it? What's your name? I mean, I knew my phone number to call my parents.
Did you feel like you were on adrenaline at all? Or were you feeling any pain yet at this point?
The pain was starting to get there, definitely. It was when we were waiting for the ambulance. They were, I guess, packing towels into the back of my leg to try to control the bleeding, that I started to feel some of the sharp pain that you would associate with a cut. And I definitely was starting to understand, like, the, I guess, the gravity of the situation or the scope of the problem. What I found out later was the crew that showed up, the EMTs were, I don't know if it's voluntary, but the same guys that were in the ambulance that showed up were laying cable on the side of the road near the boat ramp where we launched earlier. And I remember my buddy saying, like, yeah, we knew it was going to be rough when we saw the same guys that were working on the side of the road were the people that responded for the emergency services.
Well, out in the country, that's often the way it is. It's a volunteer EMT.
Yeah, absolutely. And I remember just being, I don't know if it's like let down or just nervous when the ambulance that pulled up was like that old 70s or 80s. It looked like a van, not like the boxy ambulances that I guess I would associate with the current time. So I was like, oh goodness, I have no idea what I'm about to get into. And I guess that's when things kind of took a turn. They were trying to get an IV in so that they could administer, you know, morphine and other pain medicine. And they missed at least four times. They were sticking me full of holes. And I remember getting frustrated with them, telling them that I was in pain. And it wasn't necessarily, I didn't think it was from my leg. It was just like they kept screwing this simple procedure up. And I remember thinking that the ambulance was really cramped. I wanted my leg to be kind of in that bent position where I was. Like if you're laying on your back and your knees are up in the air, that was how I had been since I had gotten up on the boat. It was comfortable. And I want to say they were trying to secure me on the gurney so that it didn't bump around too much. But that was when the pain definitely started to kick in. And I had not had morphine before that point, even though I've hurt myself dozens of times. I remember when the morphine finally started to, I guess, take effect, it felt like I was filling up with water. Like I could just feel whatever it was like filling up, and like I felt like my head was filling up with water.
Was that a good feeling or
no?
Or
no, bad? I hated it. Yeah, to this day, I would rather not be on morphine. The way I think it's supposed to work is it takes your mind off the pain. Like that's, I guess, how I would describe it, is like you're focused on that feeling that it's giving your body instead of focusing on the pain. But it made me uncomfortable. I remember, I don't know if it was like panic, but I didn't like the morphine.
Here's my hot take for today. If you see something advertised as a free trial, it might cost you more than you expect. At least that's my experience. I give up my credit card to try something for free for a week, then I forget about it, and now I'm paying for it every month without even noticing it. But when I signed up for Rocket Money, that ridiculous waste came to a screeching halt. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions. It monitors your spending, and it helps you lower your bills so you can grow your savings. It lets you see all of your subscriptions listed right there in one place. When you see a subscription you're paying for but you don't want, do you really want to spend an hour on the phone trying to track down some customer service agent to cancel it? Rocket Money can help you get rid of it with just a few taps. They also give me this great dashboard so I can see what I've spent this month compared to last month. And they'll even try to negotiate lower bills for me by up to 20%. So I'm spending less and saving more. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all the app's features.
Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/whatwas. That's rocketmoney.com/whatwas. rocketmoney.com/whatwas.
I made a decision a long time ago. When I'm out riding my bike each morning and I cross paths with someone, I always smile at that person. And most people smile back. But I do it because even though it's a little thing, it makes a big difference for me and maybe for them. It's just a fact. Small actions can bring big benefits. In the same way, it's also true that taking care of your gut can support the health of the rest of your body. Seed's DSO1 Daily Symbiotic benefits not just your gut, but your skin and heart health too. Seed DSO1 is part of my morning routine. If you can call it a routine, it's just two little capsules. And I feel amazing. It helps maintain the health of my heart, and it promotes regularity, which I can attest to. Sorry, that may be a little TMI there. For me, it's great that it's vegan, but it's also sugar-free, soy-free, peanut-free, gluten-free, and has no preservatives. It doesn't even need refrigeration. DSO1 has so many benefits, including the fact that it's backed by a lot of science, but I've barely scratched the surface here. What I can say, though, is that my body feels great. And I've got a promo code so you can see the benefits for yourself.
Trust your gut with Seed's DS01 Daily Symbiotic. Go to seed.com/what and use code 25what to get 25% off your first month. That's 25% off your first month of Seed's DS01 Daily Symbiotic at seed.com/what. Code 25what.
Hey, this is Scott. Did you know we offer a premium feed of this show that is completely ad-free and there are bonus episodes? Go to whatwasthatlike.com/plus or just click the link in the show notes of any episode to learn more and to sign up. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts, you can sign up right there in the app by clicking try free at the top of the episode list. And I hope to see you in the premium feed soon.
At some point in those few minutes of when you got me in the ambulance and were trying to stabilize me and assess, they determined that the hospital, Moriah Parham, was not going to be able to treat me for my wounds and that I would need to be taken to a specialist facility. And the closest one was the Duke University Hospital. And they deemed it was necessary for the life flight to come to my location to get me to the hospital quickly. I don't know if it was blood loss that they were worried about, but I remember them telling me the helicopter is going to be landing in a field close to here. It's going to be loud. It's going to be bumpy. Just keep your head down and just try not to freak out. I mean, I'd never been on a helicopter before. I'd flown, so I wasn't really concerned about that. I think I was just more starting to feel the pain and trying to cope with that. I remember them opening the back of the ambulance and kind of hearing the helicopter and feeling the wind. And when they started to pull the stretcher out, I don't know if they weren't paying attention and didn't lock the legs, but when they pulled me out of the back of the ambulance, they just dropped me out of the back and I hit the ground.
Oh man.
And that was the point where I guess it turned and I felt like somebody had stuck a knife into me. Like the pain was shooting and the pain medicine wasn't doing anything. So they, I guess, pick me back up and start wheeling me towards a helicopter. And I'm starting to just really suffer from the pain. And I remember once they got me into the back of the helicopter, there was a female EMT or nurse. And I told her, I need more pain medicine. She's like, no, I understand. I know it hurts. And I was like, no, ma'am, they dropped me out of the back of the ambulance. She's like, no, it's really bumpy. You know, it was just the bumps in the grass. And they looked to her and they're like, no, we dropped them. And then like you could see on her face, like, we need to get him more pain medicine. And she was clearly upset, but I guess they gave me another dose. I don't remember how long that process took before they took off. I do remember that it got dark from the time that I got on the helicopter to the time I got off. I can't imagine it was more than a 10-minute flight, but yeah, the accident happened after dinner, so it was probably pretty close to dusk. But I remember I was panicking on the helicopter. I don't know if it was the pain medicine or just the situation in general, but I was terrified that it was going to crash. I asked the lady to pray with me and just I told her, and she, I'm sure, could see that I was panicked and that I was worried. I just remember being relieved when we finally landed.
You think maybe that was, you were going into shock at that point?
Maybe. I think I was just out of it, and maybe it was the pain medicine. And I would probably say if I did go into shock, it was in that point, because I don't remember much vividly after that point.
And did she pray with you on the
helicopter? She did. She did. Yeah. I think that, or I remember when she did that, that I, I was calm at that point, and I was able to just focus on what she was saying, and she was very comforting. I'm not sure who she was, but I'm very appreciative for what she was able to help me get through. I didn't find out until, I guess, days or weeks later what was going on my parents' end. The last they knew, you know, I cut my leg and I was going to the hospital, which, you know, is concerning when your child calls you and says that. I'm not sure what level they thought this was, because I mean, if I described it as pretty bad, they probably knew that it was maybe worse than I was letting on.
And you had told them the other hospital too, right?
Yeah, correct. So they were driving north from our house, and it was about an hour to the lake. So they were flying up US 1 towards Mariah Barham. And I'm not sure who contacted them and told them they're no longer transporting your son to this. The life flight has actually been dispatched, and they're taking him to Duke University Hospital. So my dad said he did a U-turn on US 1 and got onto Highway 98, which was an east-west route to Duke. And I don't know if they were going 100, but they were probably going as fast as they could. They actually beat the helicopter to Duke. They were waiting on the roof when the helicopter landed. I didn't know that at the time, but yeah, I found out later that they ended up beating the helicopter there.
I'm sure there was some worried conversation in that car.
I'm sure, yeah. I don't know if it was, they might have been calling friends and family to just inform them what was happening. I know my coach was called at one point. I remember he was at the hospital with me. I mean, for the first 3 days, he was sleeping in a chair in the lobby. But once I was at the hospital, I briefly remember being taken out of the elevator and taken into the hospital. But I don't remember anything else until, I guess, I was in the triage room and they were debriding the wound. And I was expecting that it was going to be incredibly painful when they started taking the towels out and starting to assess. At some point, they were, I guess, spraying water into it, and it was really relieving. I don't know if it was the coolness of the water, and I was sunburned and hot, but I remember that being relieving and comforting.
And how much time had passed at that point since you'd gotten to the hospital, or do you know?
I have no idea. I would say probably pretty quickly. That was the first thing that took place. And I remember just asking over and over if I could have some water. And they kept saying, like, no, if you're going to be going into surgery, you can't have anything on your stomach. And I was just really thirsty. And maybe that's some of the pain medicine, but mixed with the shock maybe that I was in, or the trauma to my body. I remember my mom and dad coming in at that point, or at least my mom being there, and I was asking her for water. I guess she finally convinced the doctors that I could have, I think it was a wet cotton swab that they would like put on my lips or my tongue, which is just infuriating. I mean, when you're thirsty and they're just teasing you with water, it was painful. I'm not sure how long it was before the next steps were taken. I know they were trying to get a specialist into the hospital that could basically operate on me or do the procedure that was necessary. And they couldn't find one, or one couldn't get there fast enough.
This seemed kind of unusual. I mean, this is a major hospital.
Yeah, it is.
You'd think they'd have a surgeon, like an ER surgeon or something.
Yeah. And I think, I'm not certain. I guess they thought they needed somebody better than just the regular ER surgeon. They needed a specialist that was capable of dealing with that level of trauma.
Was there ever any question of losing the leg?
I was definitely worried that it might. I do remember when I was, before I had gotten in the ambulance, I just like was just checking myself, and I was able to wiggle my toes and kind of move my leg, which to me kind of like set my mind at ease that, you know, like I'm not losing my leg, or at least I didn't think I was.
And you didn't, and it kind of put it out of your mind that the possibility of paralysis.
Yeah. But I didn't think I was going to be paralyzed in that leg. But I didn't know if I was going to lose it. And I don't remember the time frame, but I do remember a doctor, it was either the first night or the next morning, saying you'll probably never run again. And that was probably the worst thing that he could have told me. Whether that's the right or wrong thing to say from a doctor's perspective, he told a 17 or 18 year old athlete that has been working to play football, you know, in college or as a career for the past. I'd been playing for 10 or 11 years at that point that I'll never run again. And you might as well just like leave me under the boat at that at that point.
That seems like such a premature prediction.
Yeah, that's how I felt. I mean, it really probably was the worst thing he could have told me specifically at that time. And I don't know if it was depression or what it was, but I felt defeated and I felt like probably scared at that point. I just remember my coach, Coach Winstead, he was there telling me, don't listen to him. You're going to play football again. You're going to play football again this year. We're going to get through this. We're going to beat this. I mean, at the time I didn't believe him, but yeah, that was really important to have people on your side telling you that it's not the end. It's not the worst.
He probably saw that as part of his job. His duty there was to inspire you to, you know, give you hope.
Yep. Another aspect of that night is I had been dating my girlfriend, now wife, for I think a year at the time, and I was just begging to see her. And she was over an hour away. She was a year older than me, and she was at her college orientation with her friend, and I was just begging for her to be there. And thinking back, I was like, I'm sure that made my mom upset that, you know, like her baby's right here and she's right here and I'm begging for somebody else to be there. But
you weren't in your regular frame of mind though.
Correct. Yeah.
What about the other two guys? Were they there with you?
Yeah, they were there with me. Brent and Jeremy. I'm not sure when they made it there, but I remember Jeremy at least was there for at least like 3 days. I remember them describing him as like almost just like depressed himself, and he wasn't eating and he wasn't talking. He was just kind of there.
Well, it was all his fault.
Yeah. And I knew that. And I don't know what made me empathize with him instead of like hate him. But I remember thinking like, I need to make sure that he's okay. And it was several days, you know, after the main incident, but I ended up lying to the police saying that, you know, we hit a bump and I fell off the front. And it was my fault, so that he wasn't somehow responsible for almost killing me. If I could go back, I would probably be honest with the police. From just strictly a financial standpoint, I think his insurance would be liable to cover it instead of my parents. And now 10 years later, my own insurance. I mean, I'm still paying for physical therapy and procedures 10 years down the line. So that stings a little bit, knowing that I guess my empathetic side kicked in crisis time, and I took care of him instead of my parents and myself at the time.
Wow. And did you and he talk about that at all?
No, we didn't. Even 10 years down the line, if he said he was sorry, I don't remember it. I'm sure he did at some point in the hospital when I was doped up on all the antibiotics under the sun and all the pain medicine. But I don't remember really ever discussing it with him.
Wow.
Yeah, even 10 years down the line.
I would think he would at least get you a gift card or something.
Yeah, you'd think. No, I think I've come to peace with that whole situation. And I wish it could be handled differently. And I wish there could have been something else. But at this point, it's not worth killing myself over what happened then and what could have happened now. So.
Right. Well, at some point, your parents, you must have told your parents what actually happened or how it happened.
Yeah, and I want to say that, I mean, I was wrestling with that internally, trying to decide, like, I don't want everybody thinking that I'm, like, uncoordinated or an idiot in this. Like, I caused this on myself, but, like, I lied to the police, and I knew that I did in my head, or the investigator. And I even think I, like, sat my mom down, like, I don't know the time frame, days or weeks after, to try to, like, tell her what happened. And she was like, oh, I already knew that. Like, I knew. And she knew what had happened. And I don't know if I told her in my, like, drugged up state. But I was really concerned that she was going to be upset with me. And she had already found out or known what had happened. And maybe Jeremy was honest with them from the get-go. And I just wasn't, you know, in the right frame of mind to understand what was going on around me. But, yeah, I was worried for a while, like, about the hole that I had dug for myself and, like, how I was going to get out, because I didn't want to be dishonest with my parents or think that for them to think that this was my fault and be upset at me.
So how did this affect your friendship with Jeremy?
I don't know that I wouldn't say that it specifically killed our friendship. I would say our friendship was very largely like 95% based around football. And he was a year older than me and graduated, and he went to college and I was still in high school. And that is what basically separated us, more so than me holding a grudge or maybe him being embarrassed to be around me. I've seen him one or two times since then, and we were pleasant. I think I was in Raleigh shopping and saw him and stopped, and we said hello and kind of exchanged pleasantries for a minute and then kind of went our separate ways.
It seems like you'd have a lot to talk about. Like, hey, remember that day? I don't know. It just seems kind of,
yeah.
I guess maybe it's something that neither one of you really want to talk about, maybe.
Yeah, I think that might be it. Me just not wanting to go there, whether it's a grudge or just, you know, just letting it be in the past. I'm sure if either one of us had a chance to redo it, there's a thousand different ways we would handle it that day, but we can't now. So
is it pretty much public knowledge now that he was the cause of this?
I don't think so. I don't even know if his parents know. I really don't. There's been times where I've wanted, like, you know, maybe I got down mentally or upset, and I was like, maybe I'll just call his parents and be like, this is your son's fault. And his dad, I always loved his dad, and his dad looked up to me from a football perspective, and he would always tell me, like, he loved the fire that I played with, and he wished he could, like, put that in himself and in other players. And, you know, maybe part of it was like a financial motivation, where if I told them and they knew, like, maybe somehow they would, like, help me out or financially.
Well, of course, yeah, they would feel obligated, I'm sure.
But I ended up deciding that that was not the right course of action. And as much as I might think that it would help me, I don't think it would. It wouldn't fix any of the situation. I would almost feel bad if they offered money at this point. I would feel like that's not on them. Like,
well, and it was Jeremy's action. It wasn't his parents.
Exactly.
So they'd be the ones that would be hurt by it.
Exactly. Yeah. And I don't want to upset Jeremy's parents. I haven't talked to them much since then, but I don't have any reason to bring pain into their life or upset them.
Did you experience any bouts of depression at all, or is that ongoing, or was it ongoing?
Looking back, I would say a lot of the time in the hospital, I may have been depressed to some extent. Certainly not now. I think I've pretty much moved on from it. There's definitely frustration, but I wouldn't classify it as depression. I would say to a large extent, I mean, the accident may have led me to the situation I'm in now. I ended up marrying my girlfriend then, and I don't know if it was because of how well she took care of me during, but it certainly helped. I knew based on how well she cared for me in the hospital that I guess she was the one. And that's not to say that I didn't know before, but it definitely reinforced in my mind that, like, this is somebody that when it's the worst, she's going to be there for me. And who's to say that if I don't get injured and I focus solely on football and I, you know, go play in college, that I lose sight of my relationship? And, like, I know a lot of college athletes lose their relationships because football is so demanding at that level. So to some extent, I may owe my relationship that I have with my wife now to the accident and the two kids that we have. So I don't think if I could snap my fingers and change it, I would at this point, because of where I've ended up as a result of it.
That's a pretty incredible way to look at it.
There's certainly days where it's hurting that I wish that it was different. But yeah, I don't know. I don't know that I would change it at this point.
How has your recovery gone since then? I mean, I know you obviously went through physical therapy and certain, probably multiple surgeries.
Yeah, let me go back to, I guess, the hospital, because a lot happened there that went wrong and went right. I know they couldn't find a surgeon the night of, and I ended up having to just basically try to sleep. I'm not sure what room they put me in, but they were they were certain they could find a specialist that could come the next morning. And I remember waking up and it being sunny, and the doctor had grabbed the toe of my hurt leg and he shook my leg to kind of wake me up, which like made the pain immediately come back. And he said something along the lines of, "Hey, Weston, you know, I looked at your charts. We're going to have you stitched up and home by tomorrow because I've got a plane to catch." And my mom looked at him and said, "Get out of this room and don't ever come back in here." And I'm not sure what type of legal battle went on, but she filed a complaint with the hospital and he was like removed from our care, and they ended up finding another specialist.
I'm just amazed at the doctors that, and I mean, most doctors are smart enough to not do this kind of stuff.
Yeah. And I guess he was just so intent on not missing that flight for his vacation or whatever it was that mm-hmm. he threw everything else out the window and thought, I'm not sure if he was the specialist, if he actually saw the pictures to my leg, or maybe he thought he was in a different room. But I spent 18 days in the hospital. It wasn't a, "We'll stitch you up and you'll be home tomorrow." The first surgery, I guess, came shortly after that morning, sometime during that first day in the hospital, where they stitched the hamstring back together. Like they brought the two severed pieces together and put stitches through the body of the muscle to hold it together, and then packed it with what's called a wound vac, which is that black foam in the pictures. And it makes, they put like a saran wrap or some type of tape over top of it that creates an airtight seal so that a small vacuum that's running 24/7 can basically pump out the fluid that's coming in there to keep the infection at a minimum. And I would say that's probably largely why I was able to heal so well, because I didn't get any infections. And the lake waters, I mean, it's nasty. So I was really fortunate to avoid any type of infection.
Well, they had you on a lot of antibiotics too.
Correct. Yeah. There was just bags and bags, like every antibiotic they had me on, which just tears up your system. Like it's definitely difficult first couple of days trying to just cope with, at that point I was paralyzed. They gave me a spinal tap. So when I woke up from surgery, I couldn't move either of my legs. I was completely numb from like the low back down, which is terrifying. Like, even though you know that it's medically induced, like, you know, eventually once they explain it, not being able to move your legs is it's a terrible feeling. But the support that basically came around me was overwhelming. My coaches, my teachers, the people from my school, people from our church, family, friends, all day, every day were filling our room. And I was fortunate to be right under the cutoff to be in the pediatric ward at Duke. And I had a huge room. Like it was a corner room. And the days were great. I mean, I enjoy spending time with people to begin with, but to have them there basically cheering me up was great. I just remember every night at 7 or 8, whenever it was, it was quiet hours where the really difficult times were. If it was depression, then that's when it was the strongest, because it was quiet. There wasn't anything taking my mind off of the pain. My mom or dad was there sleeping on the little pull-out couch. But even like when they had to leave to go get something, I just felt really alone. And I was focusing on the fact that like the doctors were telling me that this is going to affect me for the rest of my life. And it was terrible. But I do remember, yeah, my girlfriend at the time, Nikki, she was there every day. I don't remember if it was like the first week she had to have her wisdom teeth taken out. Like she had the procedure scheduled. But she came the afternoon that she had her wisdom teeth out. And we were both just sitting in there, drugged up and just suffering together.
In sickness and in health.
Yep, exactly. Yeah, my brother at the time was at Airborne School in Fort Benning, Georgia. He's in the Army. And I remember wanting to see him, but like not. I told him, "Don't quit your training. When you're done, I want to see you." I remember he got there. I don't know if it was like a week after, but that my spirits were definitely lifted by being able to spend time with him. And I didn't get to spend much time from the time he joined the Army. He snuck a TV, a PlayStation in. It's like on one of those wheel on plate, like food carriers. He had a full video game setup where he could just wheel it in front of me and he would sit in the bed beside me. We would just play video games. And you know, thinking back now, I probably ignored a lot of company because I was sitting there playing video games. But I remember that being one of my favorite experiences from the hospital.
Well, the people that visit you just want to see you comfortable and happy, you know?
Yeah.
At least I wouldn't be offended by, you know, like that. But
yeah, I would look back and I enjoyed the time in the hospital. Obviously, I wasn't there for a good reason, but I got to see a lot of people and see how much they cared for me. I enjoyed a lot of my nurses. The procedures were really painful. I would probably say the skin grafts that they had to do were more painful at the time than the accident itself. So I hurt my right hamstring, and sitting in bed for 24 hours a day, you get really uncomfortable just laying on your back that long. And I remember just being able to like scoot to my left and kind of lean, you know, like on my left hip to get comfortable. Well, they took the skin grafts from my left leg on the outside. So then I felt stuck because I couldn't lean to the left because that's where they had just shaved skin off the side of my leg to patch the right side. And I couldn't lean to the right side because the drains and the wound vac, the wound itself. So I felt trapped after they did the skin grafts. And I don't know if it was a week after I had initially got there that they did that, but I remember it was incredibly painful. So last year it had gotten to the point where my leg was aching and hurting. So I restarted physical therapy. And she encouraged me, my physical therapist encouraged me to finish the procedure and get the rest of the skin graft removed and the scar tissue below it cleaned up. And that was successful. And the skin graft that was there is no longer there. And there's just a long, probably 15-inch scar down the back of my leg instead of the skin graft scar that was there initially. So hopefully I won't have to have any more procedures on it in the future, but I'm not certain that I'm out of the woods yet.
So what sports or activities are you able to participate in now, or what limitations do you have?
I would say I'm not limited in what I can do, but I'm limited by the amount of pain afterwards. Like when I'm running and when I'm, you know, I've played rec league football, rec league softball. You know, I went to college after and played every intramural sport they offered and never really felt like I couldn't do something. I played collegiate rugby for a year afterwards, but it's getting to the point now.
Well, rugby, that's a pretty high contact sport,
yeah,
right?
Definitely. Rough. But the biggest issue I have now with my hamstring being weakened because I lost a considerable portion of the muscle mass from it, the hamstring combines with your calf muscle behind your knee to create support for your knee. And I have a considerably less supported right knee. So when I run for exercise, when I get tired and I lose my form, I quickly sprain my knee or hurt my knee or, you know, do something along those lines. And I get terrible shin splints. Yeah, part of the accident that we never really even knew happened, some part of the boat hit me in the calf muscle. And there was a cut on my calf in the hospital, but it just looked like a cut. And they didn't treat it. They didn't evaluate it. But we determined later that the fascia, or like the lining of the muscle, was actually torn. And there's about a silver dollar size hole in the muscle fascia, my calf, which is where a lot of that shin splints and aching and pain comes from, or is where it originates. And that's been equally difficult to deal with than the hamstring injury itself. And it was just something that they weren't even aware that it took place during the accident.
Do you think you'll ever stop physical therapy?
I don't think so. The only thing limiting me, if I could go once a week, every week, I would absolutely do it. It's just too expensive. it's so expensive. And insurance only covers a set portion. But I'm pursuing going back this year I just have to get a prescription from a regular doctor to see them so that insurance covers, you know, whatever portion they will. But I don't foresee myself ever being done with physical therapy. The damage to my leg is too great to really just fix. At this point, it's maintaining, trying to keep that leg strong. One thing I determined this past year is that I relearned to walk incorrectly, and I use a lot of muscles differently on my right side than my left side because I've been compensating for the lack of muscle mass in my hamstring. So a lot of my physical therapy is like trying to retrain my body to walk with a natural gait. When I was released from the hospital, they've had me in like a immobilizer. So my leg was straight, and they told me that I needed to keep my leg perfectly straight for, it was either 3 or 6 months. Like it was a long time that I needed to keep it immobile. I remember it was July 4th. I was at my grandparents' house, and I was just like in knots. My stomach was in knots. I was in so much pain from the medicine, and I was just sitting there in the bathroom with, and I was trying, it was a really small bathroom, and I was trying to get comfortable where I could like get seated, but I couldn't because my leg was straight. And I just, I guess, made the decision then that like I'm taking this brace off. And so I unstrapped all the straps and I took it off, and I kind of just like grabbed below my knee and like lifted up to kind of like let my leg naturally fall. And it was just like instant relief. And it made sense afterwards that when your leg is straight, your hamstring is at its tightest point. And bending my knee took the strain or the tightness off of my hamstring. And I pretty much decided I'm not putting that thing back on. I've never really liked following doctor's orders because I feel like they're really, really overcautious. And a lot of that's because, like, from a legal standpoint,
yeah, if they liability.
Say, like, oh, yeah. But I didn't have time for liability. You know, I wanted to advance this. So I took the brace off, and within a week of being out of the hospital, I was walking with a walker when I was supposed to be in a wheelchair for 3 to 6 months. And I only used the walker for 2 or 3 days before I switched to crutches. And then about a week after the crutches, I got rid of those. And it was just kind of like hobbling around, and I felt good. It felt good to be back on my feet. It was definitely faster than anybody would have recommended. And at that point, like, because I knew that I was beating all of these timelines, I was like, my goal is to play football this year.
Just like coach said.
Exactly. Just like coach said. And it was a battle. I had different doctors. I went to so many different doctors, and all of them were telling me I was crazy and that they wouldn't sign off on me, like finding a plan to like get back to playing football. But I finally found one, and he was, I don't know, inspired or was willing to let me listen to my body. And he gave me a few goals. He said, if you can stretch to the point where you can put both of your hands on the ground with your legs straight, and if you can do this amount of weight support, and I was, that was my goal at that point. So I spent all of my time with my physical therapist at the time, like trying to get to these goals. And he was, at the time, I felt like he was like trying to go against me. And I know that he was just working to try to keep me healthy, but I was 18 years old and young and dumb and wanted to do what I wanted to do. And I remember just battling him every day that I went, like saying, I'm going to play football this year. And no, you really shouldn't. You're not going to. Like, but we worked for 3 months, and I was able to meet all of the goals or milestones that the doctor gave me at this clinic that I was going to. And I played football 3 months after the accident. I don't remember specifically how many days, but I was able to suit up and play my senior year on the football field.
That is pretty incredible. 3 months.
It felt good from my perspective to be told, you'll never run again. You need to have your leg straight for 3 to 6 months, and you shouldn't be doing this, and you shouldn't be doing this. And I was able to battle back and get back on the football field. It wasn't to a level that I was happy with from a performance standpoint, which is understandable, but it's still, it kills me knowing that, like, from my entire career, like, I was the guy who was going to make the stop and be on the field. And I remember like the worst thing that ever happened or felt like ever happened was it was like a crucial third down play. And I got pulled out of the game for what to me was a backup to take my place. So there was still frustration. And I would say some of the battles that I had to go through was like, I'm not the same as I was. Like I made it back and I proved to myself that I could still play football, but I was frustrated that it was at a significantly lower level than I had been at before.
Yeah. So, I mean, you have to, at some point you have to mentally accept that.
Yep. So that was another just mental battle that I had to go through.
Have you gone boating again?
I have. A couple of times I've been, I essentially got back on the horse proverbially. But I guess I was never really big into boating beforehand. It was kind of a, if the opportunity arises, then I'll gladly go on it. But I'm at a point in life where I don't own a boat myself, and I don't know anybody else who really owns a boat. I've been fishing a couple of times. My father-in-law has a boat, and we've gone out on it a handful of times.
But at least you know you haven't given into the fear of, I can't get on a boat again.
Correct, yeah. And I'm definitely much more wary of when I'm on a boat, or really just in general. I think one of the big things that changed internally from the accident is being aware of situations. A lot of times it manifests in like height situations. Like I don't mind myself being in heights, like I can be there, but I'm really conscientious of other people in heights and like things outside of my control. Like if somebody were to try to push me off, or if, like specifically with my kids, like I want to be holding my kids when we're up high because I know I can hold them, but I don't know that somebody else. And I think that changed, that I'm much more conscientious of external situations and like, I guess, high risk situations.
I can imagine that, especially with your kids. Yeah, I remember when my kids were little, you know, that's instinct.
But it's been a long time. I would say most days I think about the accident still. Not necessarily the actual being hit by the boat, but just like I think about my leg and like the pain that it causes in my lower back and the aches and pains. And I pretty much have to stretch daily if I want to keep it from hurting.
Could have been a lot worse, right?
Absolutely. I very easily could have died in the water, and I very easily could have lost my leg. So I'm very blessed and thankful to be able to run around with my kids. Even if it hurts, it's a blessing to be able to have my legs still.
I hope that's the worst accident you have in your life.
I appreciate it. Yeah. When I immediately, I guess, recovered, I made like a bucket list of like the worst kind. I was like, well, now that I've been hit by a boat, I need to get hit by a car and I need to get shot at some point. And then I'll feel like I have completed all of the negative things. I haven't checked any more things off the bucket list. I've broken a couple of bones since the accident. I broke my wrist. I broke my ribs. And I've broken some fingers since the accident. But
you are unbelievable, man. Well, if you check any more items off your bucket list, get back with me. I'll have you back on the podcast.
Great. I appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to this episode. As you may have already realized, my goal for each show is to introduce you to people and situations that you just won't find on other podcasts. If you're on Facebook, we'd love to have you join in on the discussion over at our private Facebook group. You can chat with other listeners about this episode or a previous episode, and even some of the guests I've had on the podcast are in there to talk about what they went through and answer your questions. You can get in at whatwasthatlike.com/Facebook. Thanks again to those of you who support the show. Any money that comes in is going to be put toward a new microphone. If you've ever watched or listened to Joe Rogan's podcast, the mic he uses is the Shure SM7B, and it sounds awesome. And it's about $400 on Amazon. So someday you'll hear me talking on a new mic, and hopefully it's not too far into the future. Thanks again for listening, and I'll see you here for the next episode where we'll once again ask the question, what was that like?